Okay, let's do number six. And number six is to get the underlying issues on the table, or if you can't get them on the table, then at least to get them into the room. One of the fundamental truths, it seems to me, in risk communication, or at least in outrage management, is that the risks people are worried about and the risks they're claiming to be worried about are very likely to be different. And this can happen in any direction, but there are directions that are more predictable than others. For example, it's very common to have people who are worried about property values claiming to be worried about health. It's much less common to have people who are worried about health claiming to be worried about property values. Another one that's very common is employees who are worried about their jobs claiming to be worried about EH&S problems. Very, very standard. I mean, some of you know the single best predictor, at least according to some studies, the single best predictor of employees saying things like, "The solvents are giving me headaches," is when two things are true, neither of which has anything to do with the solvents. One, they hate their job, and two, they're afraid of losing their job. And that double bind, that experience of being afraid of losing a job you hate, leads to a lot of, health complaints. And I'm not talking about malingering. I'm not talking about fraudulent health complaints. They're really getting the headaches. They really think it's the solvents. But these kinds of HR problems are very conducive to that paradigm, that set of complaints. The problem for you is if people are actually worried about something different from what they're claiming to be worried about, your dilemma is how to talk to them. Because you can't tell them they're worried about the wrong thing. I mean, you can't say, "You're not really worried about health. You're just worried about property values," or the outrage will go through the roof. I mean, people feel like if they haven't got any expertise on any other topic, they are at least the expert on what they're worried about. And telling them they're wrong about what they're worried about generates enormous outrage, but there's no way to manage that outrage if, in fact, they're claiming to be worried about something that isn't really what they're worried about. If you can manage health concerns, till you're blue in the face, and if it's really about property values, you haven't gotten near the real problem. Everybody see the bind you're in. Okay. The solution to the bind, which I don't have time to go into detail on, but the solution to the bind is to find ways of getting the underlying issue, or what you suspect is the underlying issue, getting it into the room without too aggressively putting it onto the table. The handout says get it onto the table, I mean, the more and more I'm thinking onto the table is too aggressive. There's an article on my website that goes into this question in considerable detail. Actually, two articles. They're both on empathy. One is called Empathic Communication or Empathic Risk Communication, and the other is something like Empathic Response in High-Stress Situations. They both have the word empathy or empathic in their titles. And the essence of empathy, from an outrage management point of view, the essence of empathy with people who are outraged is finding a middle ground between being oblivious and being intrusive. Okay? I mean, the problem of obliviousness, we understand. Not noticing their outrage is horrible. But the other problem is just as horrible, intruding on their space, telling them how outraged they are, telling them what they're outraged about. People may not be willing to share their outrage, and they don't want you telling them how they feel. Okay? So finding a middle ground between obliviousness and intrusiveness is the core of empathy. And it is an important part of what I'm now calling, instead of getting the underlying issues onto the table, getting the underlying issues into the room. I mean, for example, to give a concrete example, instead of saying, "I bet you're worried about property values," okay, which is very intrusive and very likely to provoke, "No, I'm not. I'm worried about health. I just told you so." Instead of saying that, you might want to say, "A lot of people in this situation would be worried about property values." Or, I talked to someone last week, if this is true, you don't want to make up data. I talked to someone last week, and she was really worried about property values. Or, again, if it's true, I was in a situation a lot like yours, 20 years ago. I lived near a steel mill, and the thing that worried me even more than the possible health effects of that mill was the fear that the value of my home was going to decline. I was very worried about property values. Okay, so what you're doing is you're bringing it into the room, but you're not accusing the other person of it. Those of you who have been in therapy are very familiar with this phenomenon. I mean, therapists do this all the time, and that way, if the patient is willing to hear it, is ready to hear it, the patient can hear it. If the patient is not ready to hear it, well, I'm not talking about the patient. I'm talking about other people or me or, some other patient or people in general. Some people might feel. Okay. And those are all much safer ways of raising the issue without accusing people of it. And then, of course, you don't say, "What about you?" Or they'll say, "No, not me," and you're back where you started. So you suggest the possibility that maybe property value worries are relevant, and then let it sit there for a while, let it percolate. Don't push it too hard. Okay. Yes, sir.
Negotiations, one of the things you often learn is, with regard to this underlying motives, is what are the needs of the other side? Anyone's on this, you're always trying to think about what are the needs of the other side. And the way to determine that's usually homework prior to having that discussion you just had. So spend 80% of your effort in the homework prior to having the confrontation for the discussion. So just to determine those needs and then get them to admit those needs.
Yes.
You've got a long way to winning the negotiation then.
Yeah, you may or may not want to get them to admit them, but you certainly want to know what they are so that you can address them even if they're not prepared to admit them. Particularly outraged people. And negotiation is what you do after the outrage is low enough that people can think straight. Although negotiation calls for outrage management, it calls for outrage management usually as a precursor, because outraged people make bad negotiating partners. So if they're outraged, you have to manage their outrage. If you're outraged, you have to manage your own outrage, because it's only when both of you are relatively calm that you can look together for a win-win. When people are outraged, you probably don't want to get them to admit their real concerns, but you want to figure out what their real concerns are, and you want to get them into the room.
Just with traditional owner stakeholders, you can get a few issues there on these unknown concerns. First of all, it may be some very culturally sensitive information which you aren't entitled to know because it's secret business or something, and they can be really significant issues. And until you do something on your site to infringe on this thing you don't know, you can cause all hell to break loose. And the second thing is you may be given some reason or issue, but that's not really the key or the root cause. And peeling back the onion to get to the root cause can be extremely difficult. And I know there's some community guys in here which do this hell of a lot more than I do, but we apply some white fella thinking and interpret what we think they mean. And all of a sudden, we come up, well, that's the issue, and we go and work away on it, and it really isn't.
Yep. And, obviously, this is especially difficult when you're working with a culture that's as different from yours as Aboriginal culture. But it's not, you can be talking to people who are from the same culture you're from and still really get it wrong. And you think you know what they're concerned about, and they're telling you that you're right about what they're concerned about, and it isn't what they're concerned about. It's certainly harder in Aboriginal, cultures between an Aboriginal and a white fella culture, but it ain't easy ever to peel back those layers. And again, it's partly figuring out what the layer, what's underneath, and it's partly finding a way to talk about what's underneath that doesn't give offense. A piece of this that I need to talk about because it's very important And it's nicely summarized by this triangle. This triangle represents the three principal reasons for giving your company a hard time. And the reason we have focused on most all day is, of course, outrage. But when we talk about underlying motives, it's very important to look at the other two corners of the triangle. And the top of the triangle is greed. Now, those of you who know what I charge know that I have nothing against greed. You know, and since I know what your company makes, I assume you have nothing against greed either. But if you're uncomfortable with the word greed, you can call it self-interest or whatever term, you know, whatever euphemism pleases you. But the point that matters here is one reason for giving you a hard time is because I want what's good for me. And a different reason for giving you a hard time is because I want to get even with you. Okay? And greed and outrage are radically different motivators, and you need to understand which one you're up against. If you're up against greed, the strategy really is negotiation. If you're up against outrage, the strategy is outrage management, and they're a completely different set of strategies. I mean, for example, we said earlier that outraged people get more outraged if you offer compensation without apologizing. Okay? Greedy people are perfectly happy to have you offer compensation without apologizing. That doesn't get them outraged. It doesn't even get them more greedy. It just helps them, you know, it establishes what the, you know, what your offer is. Then they make a counteroffer, and then you're doing your negotiation thing. So knowing whether you're up against greed or you're up against outrage is very fundamental. Which is more common, to think it's greed when it's really outrage or to think it's outrage when it's really greed? Think it's greed when it's really outrage. I mean, you know, my clients are endlessly saying to me, they're after us because we have deep pockets, okay? Which is a way of saying they're greedy. And sometimes they are. There's no question about it. Greed exists in the world. But my experience is that most of your critics and most of your stakeholders who are acting upset with you are outraged rather than greedy. And let's look as a classic example, let's look at toxic tort litigation. Okay, I am suing your company because I think you gave my child cancer. Okay, what am I feeling? Outrage or greed? Outrage. Okay. What are you likely to think I'm feeling? Greed. Okay. Now let's turn it around. Okay. I'm suing you. I may cost you millions of dollars. I've already cost you hundreds of hours. I'm questioning your integrity. I'm questioning your competence. I'm accusing you of doing horrible things. What are you feeling? Outrage. Outrage. What do I think you're feeling? Greed. Okay. So, I mean, toxic tort litigation is usually a fight between outraged plaintiffs and outraged defendants, each of which misdiagnoses the other as greedy. Okay. And that's why those suckers are very hard to settle, because outraged people don't settle. And, you know, they are misperceiving your outrage as greed. You are misperceiving their outrage as greed. And it becomes very difficult. You may imagine that you can negotiate because you think you're mutually greedy, but the negotiations keep falling apart because you are, in fact, not mutually greedy. You are mutually outraged, and mutually outraged people can't negotiate until some outrage management has happened. So if you interview plaintiffs on the day they go to trial, they don't say, I hope I make enough money from this lawsuit to retire to Tahiti. You know, what they say is, more commonly than anything else, is the damn company never even apologized. Okay? Outrage, not greed. And you need to know it because the management strategies for outrage and the management strategies for greed are entirely different. We've talked about some of the management strategies for outrage. Negotiation is the management strategy for greed. You know, so things like some of you have read Getting to Yes, and you remember the concept of the best available alternative to the negotiated agreement, the BATNA. And, you know, then those are very fundamental concepts in negotiation that have nothing to do with outrage management. They have to do with mutual greed. In the third corner, ego. Okay. So, I mean, greedy people want what's good for them. Outraged people want what's bad for you. They don't want to get rich. They want to get even. Ego-driven people want to feel better about themselves. Okay. People with damaged ego, this is where shame lives. This is where guilt lives. This is where environmental justice lives. Okay. And importantly, this is where oppression lives. A very well-established reality in social science is oppressed people have damaged egos. I am not blaming the victim. I am telling you that the victim blames the victim. Okay? Oppressed people wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and think, what's wrong with my people? How come we're always oppressed? How come we never get to be the oppressor? What are we doing wrong? And that feeling of self-hate, of shame, goes along with oppression. It is, in fact, one of the most hurtful effects of oppression. So if you're dealing with people who have been oppressed, whether you're dealing with Aboriginals in Australia, or you're dealing with villagers in Latin America, or you're dealing with people in Asia who have been oppressed, or people anywhere who have been oppressed, you are working mostly in the ego corner. Okay? Because there's an order here. Outrage trumps greed. Outraged people have no time to be greedy. They have no ability to be greedy. Outrage, you know, pushes the greed out. Ego trumps outrage. Okay? Outrage masquerades as greed. Outraged people may sound greedy. They certainly make demands. It sounds like they want a lot of money, a lot of jobs, a lot of whatever. And greed doesn't have to be for money. It can be for, you know, protection of culturally significant artifacts. It can be anything. Greed is just about wanting what's good for you or good for your people. Okay? But outraged people may sound greedy, but they're not greedy. They're much more interested in getting even with you than they are in getting what's good for them. So greedy people, they want to win. If you can win also, that's fine. A win-win is no problem. Outraged people want you to lose. If they can win, that's great, but a lose-lose is all right. What really matters is for you to lose. Okay. Ego-driven people, you know, ego trumps outrage, and ego masquerades as outrage. So ego-driven people may act outraged. They will act like they have a chip on their shoulder. They won't say to you, I'm feeling bad about myself. What they'll say to you is, you know, you're a bastard. But if you diagnose this as actually an ego problem, then outrage solutions will not work. Okay, obviously we don't have another day to talk about ego management, and I probably don't know a day's worth about ego management anyway. But it's relatively clear that one of the core things you do when talking to people who are ego damaged, and you know that certainly means, among other things, talking to people who have a history of being oppressed, is you tell them about their own power. Okay. So I've sometimes worked with mining companies and oil companies and others who do a lot of work with in the ego corner of the triangle, where you have to say something like this. For hundreds of years, people a lot like me oppressed people a lot like you. We stole your land. We stole your minerals. Sometimes we raped and killed your women. That isn't happening anymore. I would like to think that it can't happen anymore because we wouldn't do it. But people like us did it. And there's no reason why you should trust that we wouldn't do it. The main reason it isn't happening anymore is because we can't get away with it anymore. Okay? The shoe is on the other foot now. You have legal power. You have moral power. You have NGOs on your side. You have courts on your side. You have public opinion on your side. Our shareholders like you better than they like us. And we no longer have the option of oppression. So the question of whether we would oppress you if we could oppress you doesn't arise very often because we can't oppress you. The question that arises now is, what do you want to do with your power? Now that you are powerful, if you want to use your power to kick us out of your country, boy, do you have a right to do that. If you want to say, no mining in my country, no mining on our traditional lands, you have the right to say that. You have the power to say that. And if you want to say that, we have no one to blame but ourselves. If, on the other hand, you want to drive a hard bargain, if you want to make us do the mining in a way that nurtures your community instead of oppressing your community, that builds your community, that protects your sacred sites, if you want us to do the kind of mining we should have been doing from the beginning, but we weren't, you can make us do that. And you, the decision is yours, it's not ours. The decision is yours. Do you want to use your power to get even with us, or do you want to use your power to benefit yourselves and your people? Essentially what you're asking is, now that you have power, do you want to use your power to mobilize your outrage, or do you want to use your power to mobilize your greed? Okay. Everybody see what I'm doing? Okay. And having said that, you leave. Because it's not until you leave that they are able to say to each other, the son of a bitch is right. Okay? And in your absence, they can have a discussion, a decision-making about, now that what you have done is you have mitigated some of the ego problems. You have articulated their power. You have validated that they have been oppressed and can no longer be oppressed. And now you're asking them, now that the shoe is on the other foot, do they want to act out of the outrage corner or the greed corner? Your best shot, in my judgment, of getting them to act greedy is to validate their ego problems, to validate that they now have power, to serve up in a coherent way the choice between greed and outrage, and then to get out of the way while they make that choice. Okay. You had a comment.
Yeah, Peter, there's another dimension to that, too. Uphold the rights of the oppressed and continues to oppress them. We have another argument in, we are the developer of choice, because if we don't develop it, more than likely a local company might come in and the option will be a lot worse. The oppression will continue.
Yes.
So we actually have another string to our bow in those types of contexts.
But it still becomes an ego reassurance. It's still, we can't oppress you. You know, maybe China can, you know, maybe your national government can, but we can't. You have the whip hand vis-a-vis us. And it's that, you know, I mean, it's that message of you are powerful, which is not terribly important to greed, not terribly important to outrage, absolutely essential to ego. Okay. So what you know, if they are in the ego corner, you're trying to address the ego, and if you do a good job of addressing the ego, the outrage starts to run clean. If you do a good job of addressing the outrage, the greed starts to run clean. It doesn't make them not greedy, it makes them able to be coherently greedy. Outraged people want infinite things because they're not really greedy, they're outraged. Ego-driven people want infinite things. Greedy people want what the market will bear. They don't want less than the market will bear because their greed is smart, but they don't want more than the market will bear also because their greed is smart. So, as good as it gets is mutual greed. Okay, what you're looking for, it seems to me, and that's what negotiation is mutual greed. You want what's good for you. They want what's good for them. You know what's good for you. They know what's good for them. You trust them to know what's good for them. They trust you to know what's good for you. Neither of you has false consciousness, and you're looking for a win-win. You may not find it. There may not be one, but you are jointly looking for a win-win. Now, in order to be able to do that, two warnings. One, don't get outraged at their greed. If you are finally successful in getting the ego out of the way and getting the outrage out of the way so that your stakeholders are unambiguously, unambivalently greedy, don't screw it up by resenting their greed. Their mobilizing their greed was the goal of the whole process. Okay? It's never going to get cheaper than that unless you find a way to oppress them again. They're not oppressed anymore. It's never going to get cheaper than that. Outrage adds to the cost. Ego damage adds to the cost. If you get the ego damage out of the way, you get the outrage out of the way. The price is whatever the price is. It's more than it was when you oppressed them, and it's less than it would be if you weren't managing the ego and managing the outrage. Don't screw it up by resenting greedy stakeholders. Greedy stakeholders are the principal accomplishment of good outrage management.
Peter?
Yes.
I want to hook something to what Jane said. Don't forget that greed could be greed for you to go away. The thing that they most want might just be for you to go away. There might not be any price or any negotiation. Once they get to the point of pure greed, and I know this from some of your case studies, what they really want is for you not to be there. So that's one of the things you have to keep in mind as a valid demand from them. Now, the issue of they can't be oppressed anymore. What that means is you, as a company that's in the world's eye, that has shareholders, you can't oppress them. But Jane is reminding us that someone else can. And Peter and I have watched a couple of companies that did not want to oppress anymore leave. One company left Ecuador, I think. Another left the Sudan. And other companies came in and oppressed the people. But those were companies that were not answerable to shareholders that mattered. You know, they were owned by governments. So we've seen honorable companies negotiate honorably and then say, okay, we're leaving. We're not going to oppress you. We promised we wouldn't, and we can't come to an agreement, so we're gone. And, you know, you can hold out that stick. Yeah, look, if we leave, someone else is going to come in, but that's still not the final answer. We've watched someone else come in those situations lots of times.
But that's the argument that Jane mentioned, that, you know, I mean, that you can sometimes say,
it's a good argument.
We're better than what's going to happen to you if you don't do a deal with us, you get China.
Or you get Bolivia.
Or you get whatever.
Yeah.
I think that's an important argument,
but it's still.
There's another point that needs to be made, and then I think there are several people who want to make comments as well. This is not just a triangle about your stakeholders. This is a triangle about you, too. You also are vulnerable to outrage and to ego. When I say the goal is mutually respectful greed, that's what Martin Buber called an I-thou relationship. Mutually respectful greed. In order to accomplish that, you want to help your stakeholders become greedy, and you want to help yourself and your colleagues and your management also become greedy, because you are quite capable of being motivated by outrage and motivated by ego. That's been a theme all day long. One of the big barriers to corporations doing good outrage management is their own outrage. And their own ego. I have worked in a number of consultations, including Rio Tinto consultations, where your stakeholders were greedy and you couldn't see straight because you were so outraged. And you were unable to reach a deal. They were sitting there saying, we want a deal, we want to make a deal, we're ready to make a deal, let's make a deal, we want you to mine in our land, let's make a deal, and you were too outraged to bargain. So bear in mind that, you use this triangle diagnostically, locate all the main players, locate the regulators in this triangle, and it's a hollow triangle. It's not like they're only in one corner. They can be here, lots of greed and lots of outrage, but not much ego. They can be anywhere, and, they can be right smack in the middle, equal amounts of all three. But your goal is to move everybody up toward the greed corner. So first figure out where everybody is, and then develop a strategy for freeing everybody to be greedy. Okay? 'Cause as good as it gets is mutually respectful greed.